Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday, February 20th, to another edition of Suspense Radio. We are pleased to have you however, wherever, and whenever you listen to the show. It's always great to have you with us. I'm your host, John Robb. Of course, all the shows you can listen to by just going to iTunes, downloading the podcast, getting it set up right onto your device, whichever device you listen to. It'll be right there as soon as the show's over. We have three fantastic authors today on the show. First, we're going to kick it off with author Adam Dunn. Then we're going to go to MC Beaton and finally Mick Sims. So we're going to have a flair from the U.S. and England on the show. It's going to be 90 minutes. You're going to get into some mystery. You're going to get into some thrillers, some suspense. Every author is going to be a little bit different within the genre, which makes it very interesting to interview because you're going to see such a nice, diverse set of writings here in the next 90 minutes. We want to remind you, too, that all of our shows are brought to you this year by Kensington Books. Make sure you check out kensingtonbooks.com for more information on their authors and their upcoming releases. Also, go to darkrenaissancebooks.com if you're into zombies, the occult, ghost stories, things a little on the estranged. They have some great stuff that they're putting out also. That's darkrenaissancebooks.com. So let's jump into our first guest. He is author Adam Dunn. His latest book is called Saint Underground. It is the third in a series kicked off by Rivers of Gold and the Big Dogs. They all three kind of came out together. But Saint Underground is kind of set today, in today's world, with the elections going on. It's extremely relevant. So we want to welcome Adam to the show. Adam, thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
All right. Thanks for having me.
So Saint Underground is the latest book. Like we said, it's book three in the series, but it's relevant as of today because with all the elections, everything going on, you kind of have a book here that is perfect for the time. So why don't you kind of give everybody the insight and the back, back scene stories of what you got going on?
Sure, John. Saint Underground is the third installment in my Apocalypse Noir series set during the Second Great Depression. This book is set during election 2016, so happening right now. It's actually set in the month of August. And what I did was, I am a native New Yorker, and I have lived through untold numbers of political conventions taking place in New York City, and I can tell you firsthand just what a nightmare it is when you are living in basically 24/7 logistical anarchy, because you have all sorts of overlapping security services basically trying to keep everybody out of the way while the conventioners go on doing their conventioneering. And it's a mess, and that's just with one party doing it at one particular time. In my novel, Saint Underground, I tried to imagine what it would look like if both parties had their conventions in New York City simultaneously.
And that right there is a recipe for, I guess, putting everything in the pot and seeing what jumps out with the stew, because, of course, just by listening to the news and everything that we have going on, it seems like the two of them can't play nice. Now, that's what they talk about. You don't know what they're doing in the behind-the-scenes stuff, but you kind of said, like you said, you set this during the Second Great Depression, so you kind of used a lot of society emotional pressure along with political pressure to kind of bring this together. How was, you know, kind of the dichotomy when you decided you're writing all this together and kind of putting it together that you, you know, had to bring in all of the emotional aspects of society along with the government and everything that was happening?
Well, the series was born during the crash. I started writing the first novel, Rivers of Gold, in the fall of 2008, spring of 2009, when it looked like the entire global economy was burning down, and I was literally surrounded by the fallout, the real human impact and the devastation that was wreaked at just at street level on the lives of everybody, rich, poor, or otherwise. There were people very, very close to me who had their, for example, all their life savings tied up with Bernie Madoff, who lost everything. There were people who had been working for large financial companies that just went smash, broke, and disappeared overnight. There were people who were thrown out of work who may have been in the held their jobs for years or even decades, gone overnight, poof. And that really was it was just like a nuclear blast going off, rocking through people's worlds, because people can be very resilient and they can take a lot, but when you suddenly destroy, when that kind of financial shockwave goes through everything, it just destroys everything in its path. And there were just examples all around me that I could choose from, walking down the street, people just standing in front of office buildings holding whatever they'd just been told to take out of their desk, crying right there in public on the sidewalk because they just lost it all in the blink of an eye. And so it was very easy to channel all of that trauma into the background of the story of Rivers of Gold, and then onward into the series, because it just didn't stop. And I know that there's a lot of back and forth going on today over whether the shape of the so-called economic recovery, that's not the word I would use, and of course, with all of the seismic shocks going on through global economies around the world today, it looks like we may be in for a replay. This after.
Oh my God! Please don't say that. I can't have my stock market money going any crazier than it already is.
Well, it's not just that though. It's what happens when you mix governments and money. And just about anybody you talk to, I think, has been touched by the rather clumsy hand of, I think, government intervention on global finances. We've got central banks around the world now turning interest rates negative. You have massive amounts of deficit spending from Washington to Beijing going on. And what good has it done? Well, the answer to that is very questionable. And so it's an environment that I think is very familiar to audiences just about anywhere, because the impact was so universal and so widespread, and it really emphasizes the interconnected lowest common denominator of society, which is money. And when you mix politicians and money, terrible things tend to happen, and that gets highly concentrated at convention time during election cycles. We are living through that right now, and that's why I have called the current election cycle Sludge Feast 16. And that is what I tried to portray in the new novel, Saint Underground, is what happens in the ways and means of campaign financing and the ways in which this so-called war chests are made backing each candidate, and also just to demonstrate what happens. You have everybody who is cooped up in one space at one time clamoring for all of the election funds to scrape these war chests together. You're basically stirring the pot and you're heating it up. You're setting the stage for a lot of molecular collisions and a lot of potential for explosion. And that is all what comes out in the book, because the book is about politicians, it's about money, it's about people under pressure, and everybody is grabbing for the brass ring.
Now, of course, there's always an underlying, and let's go back kind of to Rivers of Gold, because you have two main characters. You have an NYPD detective, Sixto Santiago, and then you have another, Everett Moore. So you have a special agent, Everett Moore, who's involved with this. But of course, underneath all of the under the big bubble that you've written with everything that's going on with government and Republican Democrats and all the slush funds and everything else, of course, you have a murder, or and you have the crime that is going on that is interlinked within the big arc, I guess you want to say. So let's dive in here first, and let's start looking at, Detective Santiago and Special Agent Moore. Give us the background of who they are, of, what their roles are, and kind of let everybody, get to understand, why they're the ones that are perfect for pushing your books.
Well, they were the ones who came to me in the midst of the dark days following the so-called Lehman moment. They were people who... Santiago was first born of a taxi series I did for an Indian news website called SuperPost.com back in 2005. That was a four-part series. I wrote pure journalism. It was about South Asian cab drivers in the New York City yellow taxi fleet. And it was right after Hurricane Katrina had pushed gasoline prices through the roof. And it was also at the time when then-Mayor Mike Bloomberg was trying to turn the so-called yellow fleet green by introducing hybrid vehicles into the taxi fleet. And I was present on a lot of the hearings down at Taxi and Limousine headquarters for this. I was interviewing a lot of drivers, a lot of foremen, medallion brokers. I was really learning about the whole taxi cab industry. And one of the things I learned about was how NYPD touches on it. In one way through the form of actually using undercover taxi cabs. They have plainclothes teams of what were called anti-crime officers who basically were there to stop street-level crimes, assaults, robberies, things like that. And they were just plainclothes undercover in taxi cabs deployed out in the street, and every precinct had one. And while I was writing my series for the news portal, I kind of started tinkering with the idea of cops and cabs and what that might look like going forward. When I started the Moore series after the bottom fell out of the global financial markets, Santiago became part of an experiment. The experiment was a new form of policing using cops in cabs as sort of flying squads to basically stem the rising tide of anarchy following a financial meltdown and the sort of social pressures that would build up to explosive levels of what that would look like. Moore is also part of an experiment, but he is an experiment from Uncle Sam's side of things. He is a government plant into NYPD, wholly off the books, completely covert, completely illegal, and he is what I see the future of interagency or so-called joint operations heading between overt, or I should say in this case, covert military and intelligence operations, and civilian law enforcement, which on the books are to be strictly kept distinct and separate from one another. You are not supposed to mix up soldiers and cops. You are not supposed to have army troops enforcing order on the streets, at least not in peacetime. That's not the way America is supposed to run. However, in my vision of the future post-crash, things have changed a lot. And in order to combat the chaos that is ensuing, some rules have to be bent, maybe even broken, and some very dangerous experiments have to be undertaken to save the rule book that we all must play by, and Santiago and Moore are one such experiment.
So when you're moving through the series, and if you start back with Rivers of Gold Book 1, and then you go through here now to the latest book, Saint Underground, when readers kind of get a sense, they can kind of see an author grow along with the characters grow. So kind of can you explain a little bit when you kind of wrote Rivers of Gold? Like you said, you started it back in 2008, but then you've learned so much from that point, and your writing has gotten much different. Either you found yourself in a different way, or you just progress, and that's just what writers do. How do you think that the series kind of progressed itself through with your writing along with, the story arcs and the characters themselves?
It got easier. The writing became smoother, more fluid. The ideas flowed faster. Or I should say the characters got better at telling the stories. I don't tell my stories. My characters do. And the material started coming along at a much, much faster rate because the characters by then were telling me where they were going. And really all I had to do was follow. And the amount of time it took to produce a full manuscript, I should say a presentable manuscript, I usually go through about half a dozen drafts to get there, shrank dramatically to the point where it would take, let's say, a year to write one. Suddenly I was writing it in 5 months or less. And also the network of individuals who helped me research my novels also grew exponentially between books one and book three. These are the people I call my technical readers. They are the ones who are involved in the professions that are described in the books: cab drivers, cops, special forces operators, intelligence agents, politicians, and so forth. And these are the people I go to during the research and the writing process to get my facts straight. I don't believe a story should drown in detail because that bogs things down, and then you lose the reader's interest. But I am a stickler for getting my facts straight, and so even though I am writing in the near future, I like to have it very grounded in today's reality to make it plausible for readers who
sure.
will at least be able to relate and then maybe be able to follow along that much more easily, that much more quickly into where I think things are headed and where I can take them. And they might be able to make that leap with me every so often when I need to rely on creative license because I'm describing something that I basically got stopped in my research, in my tracks, because I came across something classified and I had no security clearance. So the technical readers also help me with that. If I am getting too close to something classified, they tell me when to back off. And I do. I take it very seriously. I'm not out to breach any state secrets. But I do like to get my facts straight and make things believable so that readers can really follow along.
Now, I want to remind everybody that we're speaking with author Adam Dunn, and we're talking about his latest book, Saint Underground, which is the third in his series, started with River Gold and then The Big Dogs. Go to dunnbooks.com for more information on Adam and the whole series. The other thing is that, you know, you've been living this life for quite some time. I mean, you know, you're a freelance writer, and you've been living in the military, intelligence, law enforcement kind of world. So when did you kind of decide that fiction would be a great way to kind of express yourself instead of, you know, always having to write those news stories and getting those kinds of things out, that you're able to kind of explore yourself on this plane?
During the crash. I was seriously considering writing a nonfiction book on first the taxi industry and then other modes of transportation. I was also studying at that point, I was looking into terrorist financing, illicit capital flows, dirty money circulating around the world, a subject near and dear to my heart. But when the bottom fell out of the world in fall 2008, I had my series. It literally fell out of the sky. I knew then that the sorts of themes that I had in my head that so far had only found expression in nonfiction forms, I realized that there was a whole untapped vein out there for me to explore fictionally, because all of the stuff that I've been doing, all of my nonfiction, all the research, all the journalism could feed into the world that was unfolding right before my eyes, fall 2008 into spring 2009, that I could convey a lot of what I had been writing about and thinking about and wanting to say and really couldn't do in a nonfiction format. I knew that I'd be able to convey that a lot better in fiction, and I also had kind of an inkling that it would be a hell of a lot more fun.
Yeah, I mean, you know, nonfiction is pretty, you know, can be pretty bland and, you know, pretty textbookish, if you want to say. But when you go fiction, you can always kind of bring those same elements in, but then you get to have a lot more fun. You get to explore a lot more with your characters, and, you know, and also with yourself, because, you know, nonfiction writing, like I said, is pretty straight and narrowed. And this is what you got to do. But fiction, you're able to kind of, you know, go outside the box and live a little bit.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, the crash seems to be, you know, the center point of when everything kind of started in 2008 for you, and of course, writing these books, and, you know, you brought it now up a couple times. So, like, when you said now into the future here, 8 years away from where we have been, and we kind of jet-streamed really quickly outside of that recession, I mean, and all of a sudden, you know, the stock market goes from 6,700 up to over 18,000 at one point. And of course, now it's coming back down and all these things are going on. How do you kind of see your series progressing with the fuel of being able to use today's topics into your fiction because of this uncertainty and the volatility that is going on with just that, not just the economic stuff, but also the social aspect of how society is functioning right now with everything going on?
Keep reading, Mr. Rapp, because this series is ongoing, and I can sum it all up this way. Financial extremes always, always breed social and political ones. That's anywhere in the world, any point in history. If you turn the financial thumbscrews down tight enough, you're going to get all sorts of chaos coming out on the other side. And we saw it in 2008. We are seeing it right now in the bitterness, the rancor, the partisan slime slinging that's going on all over the place. The drowning out of more moderate voices saying, hey, you know, the voices of reason are being stifled in favor of basically who can yell and scream and curse the loudest. And that also happens. That move away from the center and towards the fringe also happens at times of economic stress. Look at the 1930s in Europe. What did you get? You basically got the dissolution, the turning away from democratic forms of government in favor of more mass political movements like fascism and communism. And you can see that potentially here. I don't know that the United States has always been able to retain its political center, and if you got some fringe character like a Joseph McCarthy, for instance, the center was able to hold, and the lunatic fringe was able to be brushed back. Now, that usually has happened in the past in times of relative economic stability. McCarthy was a product of the 1950s when the U.S. was sitting on top of the world. We are no longer sitting up there right now. And when you have as much overt and covert instability happening, and it's not just political, it's not just the interplay of spies, it's corporate. You have a lot of international corporate machinery kind of grinding against each other the wrong way and producing sparks. And the more political intervention you have in that, whether it's in the form of taxation or monetary policy or sweeping political legislation like we're just going to impose this kind of tax or you cannot incorporate in such and such a country, the bigger the mess becomes, because what you're doing is really you're not fixing the problem. You're putting a Band-Aid on a sucking chest wound, and you're delaying the inevitable, and if anything, you're going to make the explosion even bigger. So there's plenty of grist for my mill. And I'm working on the fourth book, The Unfathomable Deep, in my series right now. I'm also working with a co-writer, Eric Anderson, on the first spin-off series, What More Does When He's Out of Town, and the first novel, Osiris, which, as I said, I'm co-writing with Eric Anderson, will be out this fall.
Interesting. So now you kind of got a couple things that are going to be going on. And are you going to be doing two series a year now? Are you going to be doing two books a year minimum?
Circumstances permitting, Mr. Rabb. Writing, as you know, is a solitary profession. You have to balance that out with the demands of family, and one does as best they can. I have children. I have to make time for them, and I do the best I can. However, having said that, Osiris is certainly moving along at a very, very fast clip. This is the first time I've ever co-written a book with anyone, and I'm having a lot of fun with that. And the research for the new Moore book, The Unfathomable Deep, is actually coming along thick and fast to me because my pool of technical readers has grown, and I find that with each book, as I find a new technical reader, this person said, you know what, I'm reading your stuff, Adam, I want to show it to a friend of mine. He's really got a few good ideas for you. And one begets another, and information just leads to more information. And now it comes to me a little bit more freely than me having to go and try and dig it out from wherever place on my own. Now I've got more help. Now I've got the machine is running a lot more smoothly, and that helps the pages up a lot faster.
And sometimes it can also be a detriment because now you have so much information, now you're having to exclude so many things, and you're like, damn, I really want to explore this more, but I can't do it in this book. Maybe it'll work more in the next book or in a future book coming up. Are you starting to kind of see those aspects? Because, you know, the topic that you write, like you said, I mean, there's so much that you could talk about and so much that you could put in. I would have to think that that's one of the difficult parts, too, is what to put in and what to leave out.
No, that's actually pretty easy for someone with me. My background is editorial. I'm one of the walking wounds of the publishing business. Editing was how I cut my
poor
teeth
thing.
In the book business. Yeah. It's spelled S-L-A-V-E. But what it really did teach me the value of good organization and compartmentalization, because I keep different files on all sorts of ideas. I have file boxes marked just for, let's say, government corruption. I have file boxes marked for illicit capital flows, for terrorism, and so on and so forth. And as I go through and I parse through the media stream, and it comes 24/7 for me because I have very small children. There are times when I'm up at 3-4 o'clock in the morning because I have to be. And the media stream is constant, and you can go fishing. And as long as you have a good organizational storage, system in place, just for parsing and putting aside little tidbits, little morsels that you think, God, that's really great. I want to come back and do that. That's relatively easy to do compared with the sitting down and creating something completely out of nothing. If it's editing, it's always easier to pare down when you've got too much than it is not having enough and having to invent something from scratch.
Right. Well, we got about 30 to 45 seconds left. This has been fantastic. Again, I want to thank you for coming on. But I want to let you kind of have the last word where you can kind of let people know the best way to connect with you, events you might have coming up, and just to stay more in tune with everything that you are writing and into the future. So I'll leave it up to you.
Well, folks, we are retooling the Dunnbook site. That's dunnbooks.com. And we will be going live with that new, totally redesigned site next week, which will include a new blog, video interviews, a newsletter, all sorts of new content coming down the pipeline, and that is coming your way real soon. Other than that, we have book 4 in the Morse series, The Unfathomable Deep, that I'm working on now, and book 1 in the spinoff trilogy, Osiris, co-written with Eric Anderson, coming out this fall.
Well, Adam, and everybody look out, because Adam's writing an article for us for Suspense Magazine. Will be out in the next issue coming out, so make sure you check for that one out too. But Adam, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. I'm always fascinated when I get to speak with, such a deep topic and such a rich topic, just to kind of hear, from the author and how intense that, that the writing can get. So I want to thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right, you have a good one.
Same to you.
So again, everybody, that is author Adam Dunn, and make sure you check out the website, dunnbooks.com. The latest book is Staying Underground, but it's the third book in the series. We started off with Rivers of Gold and The Big Dogs, and now into Staying Underground. Make sure that you put that on your radar, and wherever books are sold, they're available. So go to Amazon and go pick them up now. We are going to take a short break. We're going to be back with our next guest, MC Beaton. Hopefully they'll be able to call in, because they are calling from England, and sometimes that time schedule gets a little confusing. But excited to talk with them, because I have been a fan of Hamish Macbeth for quite some time series. She's into like 27, 28 books now with this character, and it just keeps fascinating me because I just love to have the mystery. So we are going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back. So here you go.
Won't you smile a little, pretty baby? In my eyes, you can never do no wrong. Under the night, like the heat of day, the moonlight in our song. Been a long, long, long road to get here. Nothing and no one could ever separate.
After the break, of course, I always get confused with times. I even confuse myself with times. And I said that the next guest was MC Beaton. I made a mistake. It is actually the guest I thought was going to be on third, which, of course, I made a mistake. It's Maynard and Sims. It's the writing team of Maynard and Sims. Their first book is out. It's a Jack McCallum series. It's called No Evil. And I remember Mick emailing me and talking to me about the series, and I was like, yeah, let's get you on, let's speak with it. So here is the writing team of Maynard and Sims. Thank you guys so much for coming on today. How are you guys doing?
We're fine.
Yeah, we're great. Thanks for having us. We're ringing up from a dark and rainy London.
Well, now, like we said, you know, this is your first book out here. It's a Jack McCallum series. It's a crime thriller series that is set in 1950s England. It's called No Evil. One thing, of course, that's always fascinating to the American audience is English writers and the way that you guys write, your characters are so in-depth. They have so much, you know, force with them, and they're extremely likable in some ways. When you just look back at the famous characters that have come over in time, a lot of them, of course, were from the UK. So give us some of the background here of the Jack McCallum and the book No Evil and kind of, you know, what you guys have planned going on in the future.
Well, the first book, No Evil, we're introduced Detective Chief Inspector Jack McCallum. He's an ordinary copper who does his job. It's back in 1958, sorry, the first one. So technology hasn't really reached the police force at that point. There's no mobile phones, no computers. So it's really, you're working much more on your wits. You're working like the old detectives, like Sherlock Holmes in a way, with no modern technology to help you out. So even DNA testing wasn't around then. So it's basically a look at the way life was back in the late 50s. And I think we focus more on his family life and how his family life relates to his job and how his job obviously affects his family in a quite alarming way in this first book. The second book is coming out in May, which is Primeval, which again is all about... Again, set in Letchworth and Hertfordshire, the leafy town of Hertfordshire, and it touches more on the London underworld scene, the gangs and different gangs fighting for supremacy.
Yeah, we wanted the series to be about, it's as much about the character, particularly Jack and his family and his colleagues, as it is about the crime. So, as it says on the blurb, he's an ordinary man, but the crimes he investigates are far from ordinary. And it's a slice of what life was like. You're talking sort of 10 or so years after the end of the Second World War. Austerity was just starting to be pushed back. The people were starting to get the first televisions in their homes. Families were lucky if they had a car. It was a very different world to the world that we all live in today. And yeah, we wanted to make it an interesting background, and therefore on top of that as well, the crimes are interesting. So we started off thinking it's going to be a cosy crime, but then when once the crime started, it's far from cosy. And even the publishers started off thinking they were going to mark it as a nice, tidy crime series set in nice times. But once they started reading it and editing it, they went for a more edgy marketing plan as well. So, yeah.
You know, you set the book in the 50s. Now, of course, the 50s in the United States and the 50s in the UK was a much different thing because you were having to come out of, like you said, you know, 10 years from World War II, but there was a lot of destruction and thing that you guys still had to pick up the pieces where, you know, in the United States, the war was over, but we didn't have any destruction in the United States, but then we were dealing a lot with the civil rights issues, and those things were starting to come up a lot more. So you had two different societies dealing with two different different sets of problems. So how was it able to you, when you set that book in 1950s over in the UK, are you able to kind of give the US readers that sense of what exactly was going on in the UK, because we were going through something much different. So we don't have, you know, we didn't live through that time. So you kind of had to make that as part of a character within the series to give people the understanding, this is what was going on with us over here in the UK.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The setting and the time period is almost another character in the book. And, judging so far from that, we've had obviously had reviews from US readers and so on, and yeah, they're all very positive. We actually, the publishers asked us at the back of the book to put a glossary of terms used, because we use a lot of UK slang terms from the time, mm-hmm. which even a modern UK reader would probably have to look up, and appreciate the US readers would as well. Yeah, certainly in the London of the 50s, they were still rebuilding where the Blitz had knocked a lot of streets out, including where we lived at that time at a very young age, because we were born in the early 50s, the two of us. Yeah. And, you know, they were building prefabricated houses that were going to be temporary but lasted a 30 or 40 years or so. So, yeah, in a way, it's funny, having lived through that, albeit at a young age, to think that a lot of the US readers, for them, it's a kind of history, isn't it? And I think even school kids are learning about that period as part of their history lessons, which is bizarre when you've lived through history yourself, sort of thing.
But in a way, there are certain parallels between the US and the UK, mainly the birth of youth culture, the birth of the teenager, because I remember in the late 50s, a lot of our culture over here came from the States. We got skiffle music, rock and roll, you know, bluegrass stuff was already being played. And the influence of the States was very powerful over here at that particular time. And there was a natural resistance from our parents' generation to squash it, to not have any of this cheap American junk over here. But it certainly plays a part in the book. It certainly informs what goes on in the book.
Yeah, and we didn't have the civil rights movement at all, although, yeah, we became aware of it through the early 60s. What we had in the UK was a lot of people coming across from the Caribbean to work and so on, and although that was a government-led initiative, a lot of the people objected to that from a racial perspective.
Yeah,
and, so there were certainly elements of that that will be in the Jack Callum books, because that was life at the time. Not as extreme as in many parts of the States, but, yeah, it did form part of the UK life, certainly in and around London anyway.
There's a sort of casual racism about the UK, but it's just accepted. You know, you wouldn't want one living next to you. It was the phrase I seem to remember from my childhood. I remember my nan coming in when I was about sort of 5 or 6, 7, you know, around about that kind of age, and saying, "I've just seen a black man," and being absolutely appalled. She was absolutely stunned, because, you know, you just didn't see them over here.
Horrible attitude,
right.
But that was was the, that was the norm of the time. Yeah.
See, that's the part that is fascinating to me also, because now, you know, we're here in the year 2016 and you're able to go back in the 50s when you're, you know, into your writing and use characters and settings that is still able to bridge the difference between what Europeans were going through at that time and what America was going through at that time. And, you know, like I said, so when characters react in a certain way, us over here would be like, wow, that's so different, because we didn't act that way, or we wouldn't act that way. And so when, you know, when you're writing those things down, I mean, how conscious are you of the world audience that you're going to write? Or do you simply say, look, this is the way it was going in the UK, this is how we're going to write it, and, you know, as a reader in another country, the United States, Canada, South America, wherever, you're just going to have to understand that this is how things were going on over here, and just immerse yourself in that world that way?
Well, in a way, it's just like writing a historical novel. What you, when I'm writing, or when writing, you're very aware that language has changed in the last 50 years. We're much more, we use Americanisms much more than we didn't use them at all. So language is very different. I think a reader coming to our book is going to approach it as like reading Dickens or any kind of historical novel. You've got to put yourself in that mindset of, okay, it's not early English Tudor times, it's 1959, but it's still a part of the past. I think you've got to recognise that if you bring that to it when you read it.
And what the way we try to get around that, to sanitise it, I suppose, in a way, is we'll talk about something that happened at the time in the UK, like the race issue, like homosexuality, which was still illegal in the UK at that time.
Wow!
But the character...
Are you serious?
It was a prison offence. Oh yeah, until the early 60s. Oh yeah.
Holy shit! See, those are the things that you look back now, and you look now, and kids and whatnot will look back and say, wait a second, you used to go to jail for that? I mean, those are the things that when you're writing, that is fascinating. I had no idea about that.
So you're writing things like that, for instance, take that one issue. You're writing something like that, and you're thinking, blimey, you know, that's awful what I'm writing here. I don't really want to write that because it's so awful and ridiculous. But the way you get around that to make it more palatable is that the character, particularly Jack Callum, but the other more enlightened characters as well, will discuss that in a way that makes it obvious that their attitudes are more in tune with the modern world as we've got now, more enlightened to make the point more powerful. So hopefully a reader from the US or Canada or other parts of the world will read that and think, well, that's dreadful, but I can see the context that was in the UK at that time.
In one of our reviews that I've read of No Evil, they said an American reviewer said that some of the attitudes will make readers quite uncomfortable with the way people used to be. I mean, we've also touched on sexism, because sexism, like racism, was a casual, accepted way of life. I've got a young female policewoman who wants to be in the CID, the plainclothes detective, and she's blocked because at that time, in 1959, in the entire UK, there was less than 50 female officers in female detectives in the CID. It was just frowned upon because they assumed that women were there to have babies. It wasn't a career. You could be a woman police, but you wouldn't last. You just quit and get married, have kids. And that was the general attitude at that time.
And,
so it
you
is
know,
quite, when you're writing the books, it is quite, it's tricky in a way, because you're writing about attitudes that clearly we don't agree with, that are
right.
Clearly wrong, but that was the history, that was the time, the attitudes at that time. That was historical fact, so you're writing about that, but you just have to find a way, as I said, to make it more palatable and yeah, to shine a spotlight on it in a way, really.
Because Jack Callum is a very forward-thinking man. He's been through a lot.
Right.
He's been through the war. He's been through some dreadful things. He's come out the other end of it. And he doesn't adhere to the common, the casual sexism or the casual racism or what's going on, because he thinks beyond that. He thinks beyond the box. And I think that's what makes him an attractive character. And people in general so far seem to warm to him, because he's the voice of reason in a completely mad world.
Yeah. And then in the middle of all of this stuff that is going on and all this societal changes, you throw a crime in here with a villain that, I mean, just at the beginning, when you read the thing, when you read, you know, the blurb of the book, and the first thing people are going to notice is a girl's body is found. Her eyes, ears, and mouth have been sewn shut. Now, this is a very dark crime. And this is a time when there's no DNA evidence, you know, there's no technological evidence. You can't just pick up the cell phone, go to the internet, do anything like that. You know, Jack has to rely on intuition, skills of, you know, detection, basic, interrogation, sight, sound. He has to use all of his senses. How difficult is it to write a book set in that time without the technology, when everything written today is all about the technology?
It's tricky. It's not easy, but you have to put the brakes on. You have to stop yourself getting carried away. And you've really got to think yourself into that period, because where you normally pick up a cell phone and dial something, you can't do that. So if you're out and about and you're in trouble, like in one scene, my young policewoman gets into a spot of bother, shall we say. And what's she got? She hasn't got a radio in the car. She hasn't got a cell phone. The nearest phone she can reach is about a mile down the road. So what does she do? She's got to act on her initiative, and she puts herself into danger because she can't get help that she needs. Because in those days, if you wanted to summon your other policeman to come in for reinforcement, you blew a whistle.
Yeah.
Three short bars on a whistle. I mean, it's primitive. It's but that's the way it was, and you can't change the history.
Yeah,
it's fun. I find it fun to write about it, because it's challenging.
But it's got to be challenging. I mean, it has to be challenging, because there has to be times when you say, you know, just whip out the cell phone, and you can't do that. You know, it has to be frustrating sometimes too.
Writing about that kind of detection, in a way, is refreshing, really, because we write more modern ones, and yeah, it does sometimes seem easy to solve things, but so to actually do something where you've got to use your brain and your intuition and your gut instinct and everything, it's refreshing in a way. It makes a nice change to write something that does take a bit of thought, a bit of brain power to do it. I mean, in those days in the UK, there was a lot more respect for the police than perhaps there is now. The local, each area of a town would have a local policeman that would walk the beat, and they would get to know the families. But in those days as well, England being a sort of smaller country and the towns being smaller and so on, you would know who your neighbours were. You would know that if there was a bit of a tear away, you would know who his parents were, and you could speak to them, and the chances are they would deal with it without the police being involved. It was a totally different time. So the crimes, when they do erupt, and obviously in No Evil, there's three murders that do come in with the ears, eyes, and the mouth shut up, and so on.
That's good.
Yeah, they do.
I love it.
Stand out a lot more. Yeah.
And now I want to remind everybody here that we are speaking with the writing team of Maynard Sims. You want to go to Maynard-Sims.com for more information on this series, the Jack Callum series, with the book No Evil, with the next book coming out in May called Primeval. But, of course, the one thing that a lot of people are going to notice are, you know, you have a lot of other series that you guys have written with, so fans were able to go explore all of the crime, you know, mystery and action thrillers that you're able to write. But now, when you are putting yourself with a brand new character, you had to sit in front of a blank canvas. You had to kind of create this all new world. And there's always secondary characters that drive the story. And like you said, this book is an extremely character-driven story. The series is very character-driven. So which kind of character do you think showed themselves in No Evil with a bigger role than maybe you thought was going to happen and now end up having a bigger role in the next book, and going forward in the series, you maybe see them progressing? Who surprised you that way?
I think the one that surprised me most is the young policewoman. She's a bit of a sort of go-getter. She wants to progress through the force. She's on secondment to the CID, to the plainclothes detectives, but she's hitting the glass ceiling. She's faced with all this sort of latent sexism that's going on, and her career is being held back. And in the third book I'm writing at the moment, she actually comes into her own more. But she's a good heroine. She's a kind of good girl, basically. If that makes any kind of sense. She's got a sense of values, and she uses Jack, really, as her mentor. Jack Callum is a man. She looks up to him and aspires to be like him.
This is Mick here. I've read every, and I've got every Ed McBain 87th Precinct book, and they're an ensemble piece where you've got perhaps the main character of Corella, and then you've got the other characters who come and go in the various books. And that's how I see the Jack Callum series developing, because it's, as you quite rightly say, secondary characters that were in the first book did have more of a voice than we expected them to do. So therefore, they've found those voices more in book two, and others coming out in book three. And book four is already planned out as much as we plan. So... So I can see it running for quite a while, because it's such an enjoyable series to write, because it is so different to modern day technology driven detection.
It's different to what we've done before as well, isn't it? I mean, it's different to the kind of books we used to write. So it is a challenge. I like to rise to the challenge.
And when you speak of challenges, I mean, whenever you have a writing partner, and I've talked with several authors, you know, that have done this before, and you know, a lot of the times they will say, you know, I've interviewed Preston and Child and a lot of other bigger ones that have been doing this for quite some time, and they kind of have it down to a science. You know, somebody kind of does this thing, somebody kind of does it this way, and then they kind of run it through. Do you guys have a science now down, that you guys do it a certain way every time? Or does every book kind of say, you know what, you know, you're going to take the lead maybe because your idea on, you know, these scenes is much better than how I can write them, or this and that, or do you not? How does that kind of work together between you two writing?
Yeah, we've been doing it a long time now. We've been doing it for 40 years or so, not crime novels, but different types of books. So we've got it down pretty much now into a good pattern. Depending on the book, and the Jack Callum books are Len Maynard led. He writes them, I read them, revise them, and edit them. We've got the Bahamas series. Len started those. I took over in book three.
Yeah.
The Department 18, which are sort of crime supernatural crossovers, Len will write one, I'll write one, and then we hand it to the other one to write, revise, change, and so on. When we first started, we were primarily short stories, ghost stories, with tales and so on. And how that would work in many times was one would start it, run out of steam, and hand it over to the other one to finish it. And but these days, it is pretty much one will write a particular book, and the other one then has the right to revise and alter and so forth. Because it's with any novel, really, it's pretty important that there's a single voice that runs through it. And although we've been friends for over 50 years, as well as writing for such a long time, so it's pretty much we're pretty much in sync with how we do things and think about things. it's important with each book that there is a single voice that runs through it, and so we find that one writing it works pretty well. Sometimes we get, and we've got a situation like that at the moment, funnily enough, with a modern-day crooked lawyer book that I've started. I've got to a certain point in it, only about 20,000 words, so it's not much through it, and I've just hit a brick wall. So when that happens, we'll brainstorm it, see if we can come up with something to sort of knock the wall down. On occasions when that's happened, we've simply handed it over to the other one, who gets a bit more inspired and writes a few more thousand words to it, and then either finishes it or hands it back. So, it's a pretty much a reasonably slick operation these days.
And there's no ego involved. Because that's funny, one of the earliest, you know, swallow your ego. You can't be precious about it. You know, you're working for the common good, as daft as that sounds. Yeah. But the object is to make the book as good as possible, as readable as possible. And if I can't do it on my own, I'll toss it to Mick and let him have a go, or vice versa.
And equally, if there's something in it that doesn't work, we're quite happy to say, this is rubbish, you've got to change this, or basically the person revising it, editing it, does it themselves.
Right.
You know, perhaps moves chapter 3 to become chapter 1, or things like that.
In a way, we're like songwriters. Someone will come up with a riff or a certain verse. Someone will come up with the middle eight. It's collaboration. That's the way it works.
It's like we're on TV shows are written by a team. Certainly comedy shows are. And it's strange. In many ways, it's strange that little books are more often than not solitary creations. Whereas with other media, it does become a teamwork.
Well, guys, I want to thank you guys so much for coming on. It has been a pleasure. Time has just kind of evaporated away from us during this interview, but it's been fascinating to speak with you and talk about the new series, Jack Colum, with the book No Evil. Again, the second one is coming out in May called Primeval. It's available on Amazon. You can pick it up. So, Maynard, Sims, thank you guys so much for coming on. It has been an absolute pleasure to speak with you. Wish you nothing but the best. Can't wait to see how Jack Colum progresses now through the other books you guys got coming out.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
John, that's great. Thanks for having us.
All right. Bye-bye, guys.
All the best. Cheers. Bye.
But, so, again, everybody, that is the writing team of of Maynard Sims. You want to go to Maynard-Sims.com. For more information on the Jack Colum series, a crime thriller series set in 1950s England, like you heard on the interview, the setting is just as important as the characters. I mean, the society things that are going on. You're going to be able to see and capture those characters and that setting that is happening just post-war. So it's 10 years or so after the war. And just the differences between the United States and England that were happening. And, of course, there's a set with a crime of proportions that is just, you know, eyes, ears, and nose. I mean, eyes, ears, and mouth, stone shut. I mean, and the villains and how the writing is. So make sure you check out Maynard Sims. The book is No Evil. Put on to your calendar Primeval coming out. And sure, you're not going to be disappointed. We are going to then take another short break, and this time we'll be back with MC Beaton, finally to talk about the Hamish Macbeth series. Book 31 is out, called Death of a Nurse, and we are excited to be able to speak with her. So we shall return in just a second, and we'll give you another little piece of music to listen to. after the break, you're going to come back here. A little quick update that I have is that MC is trying to call in, I believe. I've seen her try to come in a couple times, and then the phone kind of craps out on us here. So hopefully we can get her on and get on the interview here. Sometimes it's difficult when they talk over from the UK because they have to use toll-free numbers. Things are Skyped, and things can get a little hairy. We're good that we were able to have Maynard and Sims coming on from the coast. And, of course, we were great to be able to speak with Adam Dunn, our first guest on the show. We want to also update you that we're going to have, you know, Beyond the Cover is going to be here on Monday nights. We're going to have Mark Greeny is going to be with us. Of course, he is writing all the Tom Clancy novels now. He has written his other books way back with The Gray Man, where he started out, and now he's kind of into the Tom Clancy series. Crime and Science Radio will be back next Saturday. And then we just had the Story Blender that was on last night, who was with Mark Alpert. So he was the guest with host Stephen James. Stephen's kind of changed co-host a little bit. I think Pam Johnson was the one who co-hosted with him last night. So that was interesting. But, you know, we're trying to expand the magazine also. A couple things that we have going on in the magazine that you're going to notice this year is, first, we have Craft Corner. This year, this is something that's new that we've asked a couple authors. We've kind of given them a topic question, and we've said, you know, this is kind of where your strong suit is with your writing, so we want you to kind of talk about it. First up, we have Vincent Zandri and Dorinda Jones are going to be the Craft Corner experts in the latest issue. So they're going to talk from a craft perspective in, you know, writing characters or scenes or how they kind of do what they do. It gives a good insight to readers so you kind of understand a little bit about what the author has to go through to put a book out. And then also from an author standpoint, when you're confused or trying to figure out, you know, how to construct a book, exactly what you need to do. And, you know, you're going to get some free tips here and understanding certain aspects of writing and how these things are done. We've also asked Barry Lancet and Kendra Elliott to do the issue after, so we're already working on that. So you're going to have some great insight into some different things, because a lot of things, like Maynard and Sims, you know, they're using 1950s England. Their setting is much different than what it would have been 1950s United States. So when you have to incorporate a culture that is different from basically where we are, and even from a lot of readers that are reading it over in 1950s England, you know, they might not have been born. They didn't really know what was going on. I mean, I just found out just here that homosexuality was a criminal offense in the 50s in England. They put you to jail. I mean, I had no idea. That is an absurd thing to think about today, day and age, where that would happen. But, I mean, if you think about it, too, less than 100 years ago, women didn't even have the right to vote. When you see some of those shows set back in, you know, the late 1800s, early 1900s, you kind of hear how men would treat women and kind of how those things would be. And you look now and you're just appalled. You're just like, I can't believe that would even happen. But, yeah, those things are still pretty fresh in our minds. And so this is what Craft Corner is going to kind of bring. You're going to see a different perspective from the authors and kind of how they do their stuff. I'm not sure if MC is going to make it on. I've seen her pop up a couple times, not able to get the connection with the phone. But I will make sure that we have MC on again sometime in the future, because I am so intrigued to want to speak with her on Hamish Macbeth. Again, the latest book is called Death of a Nurse, and it is the 31st book in the series. And if you haven't, checked it out and you haven't seen any of these, I mean, if you're a fan of mysteries, whodunits, I mean, this is right up the realm of, you know, Hercule Poirot and Agatha Christie, and it's written that way. Of course, it's all set over in the UK, so you're going to have a little difference with some of the terminology, but it's not anything that you can't understand. So make sure you check that out. The website is just mcbeaton, BEATON.com, and you'll be able to go there. So I know we're going to have to get her back on. But the other thing is we're working with the FBI for the magazine, and not in the current issue that's coming out here in the next week, but it's going to be after that we're going to start putting a couple cases in the magazine of ongoing investigations and we're going to talk with the FBI agents that are dealing with those investigations and kind of get a better understanding of, you know, what does it take to make a most wanted list, kind of how do these investigators go about working cold cases and tips and all the things that they have going on, and you're going to be able to understand who, you know, is out there as far as the criminal, you know, what they've done. You know, maybe we'll solve something. Who knows? Maybe one of the readers notices that the guy down the street is the person that we're talking about here. So we're going to have a couple of those cases, and we're going to get a little more in depth with the FBI, so the public kind of understands the in and outs of not just normal police work, but now you're talking at the highest level and the cold cases and the things that they have to go with. I mean, FBI and the, you know, Department of Justice is big in the news right now with them against Apple. Not going to take a side. I do have a side, but, you know, doesn't make a difference what my opinion is on this. But it's big in the news right now. Should Apple be compelled? So we're trying to bring you a little bit outside the box of just everything that goes into a suspense, mystery, thriller, horror book. And it's all these aspects of police and society and cultural aspects and all these things that have to come together as a stew and brew correctly at the right temperature in order for the book to be good. So now you're going to kind of see an expansion, but you're going to see more real-life stuff on how these things are created. I could get here and talk for another 20 minutes and only have a topic to talk about. So we're going to kind of end the show now, and hopefully, maybe I get an email from them and look back and see. No email. So I'm going to go ahead. We're going to end it, but I'm going to make sure that we get MC back on at some point in time. Just didn't happily work out this time, but maybe we can just do her in her own separate show because there's so much information that I want to speak with her about. I'm telling you, just pick up any of the books. It doesn't make a difference which one of the 31. It doesn't make a difference. And just start reading it, and then you'll see why I thought that it was important to have her on. So, again, we want to thank you guys for joining us, and we want to thank all the guests that have been on here, Maynard Sims writing team, Adam Dunn. Check out all their sites. Again, don't forget KensingtonBooks.com, DarkRenaissanceBooks.com. Support our sponsors. Go check all those things out. And, it's been a quick hour. I can't believe it's already over with, but it is. And we will see you all next time. So make sure you keep reading. Goodbye, everybody.